great to be back with you once again. Thank you for stopping by. Hope you had a good weekend. I'm Henrik, and today we're going to touch base with Richard Spencer once again and talk a bit about the upcoming NPI event in Washington, D.C. I know a lot of good people are going to be there, so it'll be good to see you there. If you're new to his work, Richard is the president of the National Policy Institute, NPI, and editor of Washington Summit Publishers and also Radix Journal. He attended University of Virginia and University of Chicago and was a doctoral student at Duke University before dropping out to pursue a much more adventurous life, considering his dedication and support to the one group or the one race, the one people you're not allowed to support. White people. Oh, the shock and horror. We also are going to discuss the migrant invasion today, where we're going to begin with Donald Trump and the helplessness of the conservatives and the GOP to do something about the demographic replacement in America. We also spent some time talking generally about the election, including Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Stay tuned. Richard, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's good to have you back, and I know how much you have going on currently now before the event, so we really appreciate you taking some time off today and speaking with us.
Well, Henrik, the pleasure is all mine. Actually, I think this podcast will be a relief from doing all the little tedious tasks you have to do to put on a conference. So we can talk for hours. It will be a respite for me.
Give you a little break. Well, hopefully some of the things we'll get into won't be too depressing, but we'll save that for later with the... Well, I wanted to get your take on the invasion of Europe, of course. There's just so many things going on now, and we just linked up a couple of stories of what's happening in Portland with all these whiteness studies and everything else, and there's some of these things I wanted to check off. But why don't we just kind of talk about the conference a bit more? You did a good show with Lana, of course, a couple of, it's more than that. It's probably a few months ago now, I think, and you guys spoke a little bit about the event and whatnot. But, yeah, just give us a little bit more. It's about 2 weeks to go when this show is going to be published, a little bit less. So, of course, those who want to try to get tickets and whatnot should do that right away. How are things going? Is it selling out?
Well, I think there is a very good chance it's going to be sold out. It's going to be sold out because we've just had a real consistent demand for tickets. And I think you would agree with me that something's happening. And I don't know quite what it is, but I just think there's more passion for our ideas online among young people than there has ever been in my lifetime. And I think people are kind of getting a sense, like, let's bring this on, let's take it offline, let's see, you know, let's meet up in the physical world and meet each other and make plans and just build a network about real people and not, you know, anonymous Twitter accounts, which for better and for worse is our movement in a way. I've been overwhelmed by the demand. And I think also we just have some great people coming. Kevin McDonald will be there. I think it's a real treat, to listen to him or meet him. Actually Guillaume Fay from France, who's been, you know, God, he's really an indispensable guy in theorizing who we are and what we're about and where we want to go. Keith Preston, who I think he's been on Red Eyes Radio a couple of times.
Yeah, Lana spoke with him, on 314, for sure.
Yeah, and he's a very cool guy, an anarchist. I'll be there. Romain Bernard, also from France, will be there. He always says something highly provocative. Jack Donovan, who's also been on Red Eyes Radio, he's going to be there. And Sam Dixon, who's a classic speaker, he'll also be around. And he's actually going to talk about the South and the attacks on Southern identity, and really also kind of the tragedy of identity, which I think is of equal importance. Then actually, I would say that the thing, all those speakers are great, but I think the thing that I am actually most looking forward to is the fact that we have Robert Taylor, and who's well known for being one half of the band Changes.
Right.
And he's going to be there with a friend, and unfortunately the other half couldn't make it, but we wanted to do this badly, both Robert and I. And so Robert's going to be there with another friend, and he's going to talk to us, but he's also going to perform. And I think this really expresses what I think these conferences should be about. And, you know, and I say this as a speaker, but, you know, speakers are kind of the excuse. You know, no one really comes to learn something. Because, you know, look, great speeches are, I love them, and I love being stimulated by them, and, or, you know, getting into a tete-a-tete with someone. But it's really not about the people at the podium. It's really about building a community and meeting people and building a network. And so I imagine this, you know, it's Halloween, which already gives a little bit of edge to the whole conference, but, we, you know, ghouls and goblins will be out and about, but also just the fact that we're gonna have someone perform music, we're gonna sing together. I think it really expresses what I think these things should really be about, and that is, community. And I'll also mention, I have not actually announced this yet. I'm gonna do this in the next couple days, so, but we're going to do something that is also quite new for us, and I think is going to also be very fun, and that is a group podcast. So on in the afternoon, at the end of the day, and at the end of the day portion of the conference, because it kind of has two parts. There's a day, and then at night we'll have the music and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I'll be there. Jack is going to be there. Yulana will be there. Actually, Mike Enoch from the Right Stuff Radio will be there. And so then also the audience will be there. So we're going to do something that I think we're going to pull it off. It might be a little chaotic, but we're going to try to do a live podcast where we, you know, maybe talk about what has happened, or we just shoot the breeze about the world. And we can also get audience feedback, because we'll everyone will be mic'd up. So it will be, you know, our little talk radio there for a moment, where people from the audience can come and, I don't know, scream at us or something. But we'll see what happens. But anyway, I just think it's going to be a lot of fun. The demand has been great, and so it's going to be a packed house. You know, again, it's all about community and meeting people, and that's definitely what we'll do. So, again, if you're hearing this and you're kind of on the fence, just do it.
Yeah, exactly. Show up. There's going to be a lot of good people there. And I think it's probably more important than ever to a lot of people. I mean, it always is in movements, if you will, like this. But at this time, just as you say, I think there's more need and hunger for that than ever. Not only for the fact that we're being painted into a corner of sorts, but at the same time, this is the opportunity, of course, where people get to talk with others, like-minded people, and that's never a bad idea, to network and to connect with other folks. And why do you think it is that it's gaining the momentum that it is at the time? We have so many things going on online, from the whole millennials and the reactor sphere, or dark enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. It's really picking up pace, you know?
Well, I just think that there are a lot of different things all coming together, all dovetailing around this. And I think the refugee crisis, so-called, which I agree is basically an invasion, you know, this is the kind of thing that used to be about our nightmares or our horrifying novels, and it's happening instead in real life. And it's not, you know, people like me are seeing it from afar or reading about it, but other people I've talked to, this is real. I mean, there was a crazy story about a town, a little village of 100, and this totally demented German mayor is bringing in 1,000 Syrians or something.
I saw this story, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like if we were to parody what's going on, we wouldn't do something that outrageous. But, you know, it's just, I think that's happening. It's a kind of, you know, apocalypse now, so to speak. You know, it's like the future is here. And I think that, you know, in a very different way, I think the Trump campaign is a part of this. It's not so much, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this actually in my speech. It's not so much that Donald Trump is really a great savior, or he's, you know, I personally find him hilarious, but I admit he is a bit of a clown, and I think the kind of things he promises, that, you know, he'll just be in office and he'll make a deal with China and then everyone's going to be rich or something, I think that's obviously absurd. But what I think is really fascinating about Trump is that he is just totally delegitimizing all of these forces that have been really negative. He's delegitimizing the Republican Party because he's bigger than the Republican Party. He doesn't even play by their rules.
Yeah.
He scoffs at their rules. He's delegitimizing the conservative movement, which is I don't even want to get into them, but it has been a terrible movement for our people because it's been this dead end street. It's been this dead end alley that we keep channeling people into. And it leads nowhere. And the fact that he is showing them up, that he's delegitimizing them, that he's making fun of them, I think is great. He's doing that to Fox News. He's doing it to other things. I think just people, there's been a kind of movement on Twitter that you wouldn't necessarily even say it's dark enlightenment or nationalist or identitarian or something. You could say it's almost a hipster nihilism. It's just a sense that we live in this world where we're not allowed to speak the truth. We live in this world, we live in this world that's just too soft and comfortable and that cares too much about, you know, little victim groups and so on and so forth. And just like, let's start speaking our mind. Let's start getting real. And I think a lot of those people are, I think in a way they feel empowered by the Trump phenomenon. And I think also in a way they're becoming open to our ideals. You kind of, you know, you sometimes have to start somewhere and you end somewhere. You might start in this place where you know that something is really wrong with society, but you can't really pinpoint it. But you kind of get at it by making fun of crazy feminists or, you know, yeah, Gamergate or some race hoax on campus or what have you. So that's a kind of an entry point. It's a way that you grasp that something's going wrong. And I think, you know, one thing that I think we're really doing this is that we're kind of bringing those people up to something higher and better. And we're not, you know, they know how to say no to a lot of things. And I think in a way, our challenge is to teach them also how to say yes to things. That it's not just a matter of that those feminists are crazy. That professor on campus is a total lunatic. She's instructing us on, you know, dildo technique as opposed to, you know, history.
Yep.
Or that is history now.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But anyway, you know, you can say no to that, but are you going to say yes to something? Are you going to be part of a movement that's leading to something better and higher and greater? And I think that is really our challenge, to kind of get those people going in a new direction. But I think what is so exciting and why this conference is getting a lot of interest, I think other conferences will get interest as well. Small events will get interest, big and small and all, everywhere in between, is just because I think a lot more people are open to it now. They're seeing that this, you know, they're getting a raw deal from the status quo, and they get it in their gut that it's wrong, and they're open to something that is better and higher. And so, you know, again, I'm obviously biased when I say this, and I have a tendency to get enthusiastic about things, but I actually think my enthusiasm is grounded. I just think we're seeing a big structural change, and this is not going to happen, you know, overnight. We're not going to have the conference and then suddenly, you know, Red Ice Radio has replaced NBC News or something. But it's going to take a long time. I think this is a decades long proposition,
yeah,
but it is happening. I think my euphoria is really well grounded in that sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we can focus on Europe a little bit later, but Trump, I mean, it's very good what has happened, although he might not be, as you say, the obviously ultimate candidate here. But he's not abiding by the rules. He hasn't really backed down. He doesn't apologize. He has utterly crushed some of these stupid reporters and any other candidates too at the debates. So he's really blazing a kind of a politically incorrect path here. And the popularity that this has yielded, I think, is going to cause others and force others to look in this direction, that people are, it's not as much as what he says yet, which I wish was the case, but it's about how he's doing it, which is well received by the majority of people right now. And it's a good, that's a good sign.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also what he represents. I mean, and I, and in this way, I would criticize Trump. I think it's a backward looking movement. I mean, it's very slogan, "Make America Great Again."
Right. Yeah.
Expresses that, but I don't think, I think that's in a way okay. I think sometimes, you know, our movement might be a little too forward looking and heady, and you know, we're talking, you know, the coming ethno state and who are we as a people and civilization.
What colors will there be on the railing when we have? No, yeah, exactly. I know what you're saying.
Yes, but we should talk about that. I want to design those, but bronze, you know, railings, but in the ethno capital. But you know, what I'm saying is sometimes our movement gets a little heady and fantastical, and I think that's good because I think you need that. But I think a movement that is kind of looking, that's about people who feel like they've lost something and they want it back, that's a more immediately dangerous type of political movement. And so I think that is what he represents. And it's ironic, funny that you have this rich oligarch representing this movement that is a populist movement. But I think it makes a kind of sense. You know, all of these candidates, like some of them that have, or others like Scott Walker, they'll do all the typical political bullshit of any candidate in America and Western Europe and so on. Of, you know, they'll go eat a hot dog with this lady, or they'll go to a diner and eat pancakes, or they'll wear a jeans and a, you know, quail hunting jacket and a hat, a trucker cap, and talk about how normal they are, or something like that. But that's all, as I say, and I apologize for cursing, it's all bullshit, you know,
right?
Because there's no better word for it.
Yeah.
But Trump, in a way, is who he is. I mean, he is a oligarch, and he plays that as a kind of populism. And I feel like there's this honesty to what he's doing that's shocking. And you can even take that on another level, because, you know, as we've seen, there's actually a lot of evidence that some black people, this is the one Republican that they kind of will vote for. And I think the reason is that he is what he is. He's hilarious. He take no prisoners, make no apologies guy. I think they're finally someone that they just viscerally respect. And who knows? He might actually be the one that would do the most for them by cracking down on illegal immigration. But
right.
But you put that aside. I don't think elections are really about issues. I think elections are about feelings and emotions and hatred and fear and hope and things like that. So, but I think what Trump ultimately represents is the white American public. And he is their champion. And the fact that this is actually happening is remarkable. And I think also the fact that he is being attacked by conservatives and the Republicans is quite remarkable. Because remember, the GOP is the white person's party. I mean, it's
right.
90% of the votes cast for the Republican Party come from white people. So, I mean, this is a party, this is a totally white party. It's a much more ethnically or racially homogenous party, certainly than the Democrats. And yet, it's this party that, it's an ethno-politics that dare not speak its name.
Yeah.
Quite unlike the Democrats, who are more than happy to say that we're the party for Hispanics, we're the party for blacks, we're the party for gays. And so, in a way, what Trump is doing, I mean, however popular he might be with non-whites in America, what Trump is doing is that he's really representing the party as it is. You know, he's making this all about what are effectively racial and cultural issues. It's all about immigration. It's all about demographics.
Yeah.
And you know, all the things that go along with that, you know, security and just living standards and so on and so forth. It's all about race and demographics. So he is doing what he's doing explicitly or almost explicitly, what the GOP has been betraying, you could say, for decades. So for decades, the GOP was the party of white voters, but it did very little, nothing, probably negative things for them. And then now Trump is like, this is who we are. This is what it's really about. And these people hate him for it. I mean, it's in a way amazing. I mean, he's doing what they should be doing to reach their voters. He's the only one. Yeah, I don't think he's a savior. He's the only one who might actually do something for these people who vote for this stupid party.
Don't they get? I mean, as far as the other candidates are concerned, they have just bypassed the white majority population in America and peddle to all these minorities and try to get their vote as opposed to winning the vote they already have. You know.
Right. Well, I think they take it for granted. But I think also it, in terms of what you were just saying, I think it goes deeper where, you know, white people are the race that dare not speak its name. I think Trump kind of walks that line. And so he's able to do it. But, you know, this is the fundamental asymmetry of American politics and really politics around the world. Is basically ethnopolitics for everyone else and a kind of universalistic non-identity politics for white people. And what Trump does give me hope is just that, can he really win this thing? I think he has a very good chance to win the Republican nomination. I would put him as a favorite. Could he then win a national election? I'm not so sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what comes after Trump? Might Trump be this man who unwittingly just kind of opened up space and smashed these things that really need to die? The Fox News conservatism, the GOP establishment, the conservative movement, a bunch of fuddy-duddy, closeted homosexual, you know, religious fanatics who live in Washington, D.C. You know, he smashed all of these stupid, terrible things. And might he be the one that opens up space for us? And again, I'm being wildly optimistic, but I think there's a chance for that. I really think that there is a chance that he's in a way he's the end of something and he's the beginning of something. That's what I hope for.
Yeah, I mean, demographically speaking, is this one of the last times that the Republican, a conservative, might have a chance to get in, do you think? I mean, many people have mentioned this, that it's if it continues much further, that's going to be it for the Republican. Not that they are, as you've explained, not that they represent the interests, of course, of white European Americans, but nonetheless, they might do it a little bit better than the Democrats.
Yeah, perhaps. They at least, you know, say the right things and signal that way by talking about their love of God and guns and, you know, and traditional values or whatever. But no, in terms of a concrete something, they don't do much of anything. Yeah, I mean, Peter Brimelow actually did a lot of very good work on this in the 90s, and he just projected forward linearly about demographics and voting patterns, and said that 2008 would be the last time that you could elect a white Republican candidate, and he was quite very prophetic. I joked not too long ago. This was actually before Trump entered the campaign. I joked that Hillary Clinton would be the last Anglo-Saxon president of the United States.
Might happen.
I think we're getting there. And I think we'll also, I don't know. I mean, I guess this is actually questionable of the degree at some point where we're really going to have post-white politics in America. Where it's not just going to be people like Hillary Clinton, you know, ruling over a multi-culti Democratic Party, but whether you're going to, whether we're going to have a Hispanic presidential candidate, a mixed race. I guess we have had, you know, with Barack Obama, although he's been a rather white candidate, in my opinion. But I don't know. Are we going to go over a boundary and really start to have a post-white politics. It's yet to be seen, but that seems to be the way. But that's also kind of uncharted territory. What politics are going to be about, you know, when they're like that. We're kind of used to things. We think that this is what politics is, that, you know, we argue over taxes and abortion and, you know, little foreign policy things, although foreign policy really doesn't change between administrations, but we like to argue about certain things. And I think it's questionable what the politics of the future, if it's going to really be about any of those things. You know, we just have a tendency to think that everything's going to stay the same. We have this, it's a very human tendency just to think in terms of maybe a linear movement, but basically think in terms of the status quo, that things are going to ultimately be the same. It's very hard for us as humans to think about cataclysmic, dramatic change and these big reversals. But that must happen. This post-war consensus on issues, and you could say a kind of consensus to disagree about certain things. You know, we're going to argue about abortion. We're going to argue about whether that, you know, this tax rate or what are the other things they talk about? I don't know. I only like the carnival aspect of politics. Actual issues kind of bore me, but you know, we've had this consensus for some time, and how long is that going to go? I think it's just got to change. It just has to, and we don't know what that's going to be. And you know, again, it's to go back to what I was saying earlier. It's really our challenge to be a part of that, to be a part of the politics of the future, to inform how a political actor will think about the world and act. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. On the other side of the coin, or the other wing of this beast, we have Bernie Sanders. I haven't followed him too much, but isn't he kind of popular on that end as well, the other end? He's because he's obviously more extreme than the others from a socialist perspective. It means that the candidates in America are becoming more extreme or radicalized, if you will. I mean, it might be the Trump against Bernie Sanders here. You know?
Well, that would be interesting. You know, I have to say, in 2008, I actually supported Ron Paul. I thought that was he was the best candidate. But I actually had some respect for Barack Obama as just simply as an anti-war candidate. And we might have forgotten about this because, we've had the financial crisis and then all this stuff in between in these past 8 years. But really, in 2007, when the campaign got started, he really was a seemingly genuine anti-war candidate. And I almost had a certain respect. And there's something about, you could argue that Bernie Sanders might, I don't really think so, but you could argue that Bernie Sanders kind of has a little bit of that spirit to him. He's made some, I'm trying to basically be as kind to Bernie Sanders as I possibly can, because probably everyone expects me to be like, oh, he's an awful Jewish Zionist socialist or something. But, you know, he has made some kind of funny statements. He said, I hope America will become more like Scandinavia.
Yeah, but not demographically speaking, right?
No, not demographically. And he was attacked, actually, by Hillary Clinton for not being tough enough. They always use the word tough on guns. He's not tough enough on guns because he ultimately does live in an all-white state like Vermont. And it actually proves in some ways that were it not for a lot of these polarizing racial elements, I think a lot of people might actually prefer a kind of benign, patronizing socialism to kind of make sure that they're the job has some security to it and the market isn't too chaotic in which they work. Bernie Sanders is what he is. I think he too is a bit of a figure of the past. Not just because of his age. I think in terms of his mentality and the way he looks at the world. When I'm talking about what we're going to see in the future, I really think we're going to see a different kind of socialism. There's going to be a white privilege tax.
Oh yeah.
There's going to be, you know, something like that. There's going to be a, just whole new things that we can't really imagine. And there's going to be a new kind of populism that isn't the race card playing or race baiting that we've seen about, you know, when Hillary will talk about how she loves immigrants or she'll put on a southern accent, you know, occasionally. These are really funny videos, if you can see them, where she'll start talking black or talking southern. She'll start dropping her G's and say my child for child. It's really awful. But that's the kind of bullshit, for lack of a better word, that I would expect from a liberal politician. But what I'm saying in the future, I think there's going to be something much more radical, something we don't really know what it is yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But something, you know, forced integration of a style that we haven't seen. Not just we're going to have affirmative action in college and corporations. Something real nasty. Again, a white privilege tax, some totally ill-defined thing that will, you know, go on definitely. Just there's going to be a kind of racial populism that just people aren't used to. And I think it's just if we keep going on as we are, we're going to see this. And this post-war consensus that we've all gotten used to is going to be smashed.
You know, you were speaking a bit about how Bernie Sanders were kind of looking at Scandinavia. I remember reading, I forget the paper now, the online paper. It was a pretty good example of how these, you know, milquetoast conservatives, how utterly kind of disgusted they are with the concept of race. The story was basically about this conservative writer. He had found out.
Kevin Williamson?
Was that it? He was talking about the dirty secret of the Democrats, that they were secretly wanting to turn America into Scandinavia, right? Because it was so white.
Well, I don't think, I'm sure there's some conservative who said that. That's a truly idiotic opinion. So therefore, a conservative has probably thought it. But I think actually it was a Kevin Williamson piece. And Kevin Williamson is one of these National Review writers.
It probably was National Review. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Right. I think what he was saying was that, you know, the dirty, it was a very odd argument, but it was kind of like the dirty secret of these liberals is that they love socialism, but in a way, socialism can only work in an homogenous environment.
Exactly.
You know, the best examples of a welfare state are Scandinavia or Germany, where you actually do have productivity and what I think we might even agree a certain degree of kind of stifling welfare. You know, the welfare state is kind of the end of. It is the end of history, just in a different way. America, and you could say that with these drastic differences between tax rates and welfare usage between America and Scandinavia, but they've just kind of, in a way, reached a certain kind of passive nihilism just by different routes. America's reached it through consumerism and the Walmart route, so to speak. And Scandinavia has reached kind of the same type of human being. Basically, a human being is an economic consuming entity, but it has reached it through government. I'm not sure which is worse.
Well, you know, it's true to a certain extent that when you look at the welfare state such as it existed in Scandinavia, it did work for a while. I mean, it was efficient to a certain degree because it was shameful to be on welfare. So you didn't abuse it in that way. And on the other hand, I think it's equally a kind of a libertarian, I don't know, some kind of anarcho-capitalist society. These are ideas that are white ideas. These are concepts that only would work in homogenous nations, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just we're gonna have a vastly different type of socialism. And you know, in a way, America kind of reached a certain degree of this. Cause remember, I mean, America's defenders and critics will both agree that it's a capitalist state. So remember, this is the largest government ever on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not, you can't describe this as anything other than some, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but it is a socialist entity. It just doesn't do the socialism, the kind of socialism that in a way helps people in their average everyday life. You know, but yeah. it does a tremendous amount. It does do some, certainly welfare socialism and payouts to people. The healthcare industry is humongous in this country because we've reached this kind of worst of all possible worlds where we inject tremendous amount of money into this healthcare industry, but then we're not really providing the healthcare. And so it's just this horrible industry that's massively expensive and wildly inefficient, yet ultimately isn't socialized to the point that, you know, a citizen can go get his broken arm mended. It really is the kind of worst of all possible worlds. The socialism involved with America's geopolitical footprint, and its foreign policy. I mean, do you just imagine the kind of billions of dollars flowing between government and contractors and weapons manufacturers, this whole area around the world that we're supposed to be so proud of their bravery to, you know, engage in lunatic wars or sit around and do nothing. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah. America is a kind of mirror reflection of the Soviet Union. I mean, it is a massive socialized geopolitical entity, but it's just done it in different ways, and where we don't really kind of recognize it as such. But yeah, I mean, we again, this really was the 20th century was this U.S. and SU, they're two massive entities that both claim to be the end of history. This is all anyone could ever want. It's either, you know, Walmart or real existing socialism. And they also had desires for the entire globe. I mean, both of those systems, maybe in a way to a lesser extent for the Soviet Union, but both of those systems had a very difficult time imagining a different way of being on this planet. You know, you were either a socialist or a capitalist.
What is it? Right.
And it just, you could see this in even in some of the conservative movement of better dead than red. You know, it's a kind of all or nothing. And both of these entities, the Soviet Union and the United States equally, maybe even more so on the part of the United States, had this just expansive universalizing impulse where it could not tolerate something different. And as we look back on history, I think in a way the Soviet Union might have, at least geopolitically, not internally, but geopolitically, might have actually been a little more intolerant, tolerant and kind of realistic after its expansionary kind of Bolshevik phase.
Right.
And this is where we are. But I really think that these things are coming to a close. I think we are witnessing. We're certainly witnessing the delegitimization of the United States. And it's sometimes hard to believe this because I'd never thought I would see it happen. But we're witnessing, attenuation of America's global power. And I don't know how anyone could argue against that. I mean, we're witnessing that. I think, you know, we certainly in Syria where, I mean, this is a very interesting thing that's happening with Russia. But I think that the fact that America didn't go into Syria, I guess around 2 years ago in 2013, I thought that was a huge development. We're certainly witnessing the delegitimization kind of morally and metapolitically of America. That's been happening for actually many decades. But I think we're actually witnessing the delegitimization physically. That is a slow reduction of this empire. So, you know, all those things that I was talking about, America as this global player and so on, we're reaching the end of that. I think what kind of world we're going to see in the next 100 years is something that, you know, none of us really know what it's going to be about yet. We are experiencing this disintegration of all the things we took for granted in the 20th century. And, I guess it's up to us to determine what comes next.
Yeah, you know, America, well, it was a couple of years in between, but largely they kind of took over after Britain, the Victorian era as kind of ruler of the block a little bit. I wonder what kind of future here we're looking at, and who's going to fill the void and the gap, because obviously it's not going to last. It's not going to work in the long term. Even just the economic situation and the demographic decline of the white population, you know, who's going to pay for all of this? So it could go in so many different directions when this beast falls, you know?
Right. And we should also give the devil his due, in the sense that no one else was really stepping up to fill that void with America. I mean, particularly after 1991 and the Soviet Union's demise and Russia's fall from, you know, hyper or superpower status. No one stepped up to the plate. No one came in to fill that void, because, you know, we should admit that there probably has to be some kind of unifying system. I talk to some people, and it's almost like they believe in multipolarity as an ideology. You know, like it would inherently be better if there were all these different players and there wasn't one system. And, you know, I can kind of get that, or I don't know, that actually sounds like it might be worse, or at least more violent.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, and again, this is something I think we should always do, is give the devil his due. America did form a unifying system for the globe. And we can criticize that. We can say that it was nihilistic or egalitarian, and I would agree with that. But it did accomplish that. But I think what really the question is, you know, I think that we're all always interested in is what's happening going forward. Because this Pax Americana is ending. It is disintegrating. We are witnessing that disintegration. I don't know how anyone could argue against that. And, you know, what is this new world going to be? You know, if we want to think of ourselves as a racial idealist or as identitarians, what kind of world do we want to see? Not just in terms of our own, you know, internal countries, but how are we going to get along with other people on this globe?
Yeah.
How are we going to trade with them or deal with them diplomatically? What are these things that are going to, you know, keep us from killing each other or something? You know, and those are things you have to think about. And I think that's actually something that we haven't really thought a lot about yet. You know, if we can, you know, if we can imagine something coming out of this disintegrating world, what do we really want?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, because something is going to come in and fill that void.
Right.
You know, and so it's a matter of who, well, this is kind of what history is about, really. Those who take that opportunity, they have the, everything is lined up and the timing is right, and they go for it and grab it, you know? So,
yeah, I don't want to get into China bashing, but I also would be lying if I told you that a Sino-dominated world strikes me as particularly attractive.
Right, exactly.
That's not what I want. And I'm not even sure China, that they're up for that challenge either. But putting that aside, that's not the kind of geopolitical world that I want. So, you know, this really is something that we have to ask ourselves, is not only what kind of countries do we want to see, you know, internally, but how are we going to get along?
Yeah, definitely. Do you think it's to our advantage that things are moving as fast as they do? I mean, particularly it's bad in Europe, certainly, but it's not much different in America. And, you know, Obama is shipping in a lot of Syrians too, and a lot of other people are piggybacking on this. People are coming over from the border from Mexico, not only Mexicans, I think it was Somalis and Nigerians who were coming over as well. It's moving so fast that I think the momentum that's building up is, although as horrible it is to witness and see it, it's still something that is to our advantage, that is causing people to associate this very negative event with an opposition that has to rise from this, right?
Yeah, I think it is to our advantage. I mean, of course, we're not ready. So, you know, but that's our fault in a way. But I really ultimately believe that this system, this Americanized world, is going to really have to be smashed for something else to come in its place. And by saying that, I don't mean that we're going to be the ones that are going to smash it. We're not going to be the ones who are going to smash it. We're effectively, well, we're basically powerless. We have some power of ideas, but that's about it at this point.
Yep.
It's going to smash itself, and it's going to come crashing down due to its own contradictions. And I don't think that we should be spending a tremendous amount of energy trying to rescue it from itself effectively. I know that probably sounds like I'm making a worse the better argument, and in some degree I am. I don't think that, again, to kind of return to what I was saying before, I don't think the disintegration of America as it's currently constituted is necessarily good or bad for us. It might very well be much worse. What could arise in the wake of, and what could arise in post-America could be some horrifying totalitarian entity, some Pol Pot-style socialism. It could just be chaos, you know. But it really is incumbent upon us to make sure that we have a vision for the future. So that's what I'm in a way concerned about, is not just trying to save America or save Western Europe. It's really, you know, what kind of world do we want to live in? And just to go to back real quickly to what you're saying about the acceleration of this crisis, you know, I've mentioned this on a couple other podcasts, and it's something that's I've been thinking a lot about. But I remember spending a lot of time in Germany about a dozen years ago, and I was actually learning German, and I was doing some small jobs here and there. It was really all an excuse, just because I wanted to go. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be in Europe. I've always had a bohemian streak, so, you know, I didn't need that much money. I just wanted to be over there. I wanted to experience something that I had been reading about, you know, whether in history or philosophy or art or music and so on and so forth. And, you know, for me, so about a dozen years ago, this was during the Iraq war debate, and the way that was usually codified was that America was this good right-wing traditionalist power, and there was decadent Europe, which was left-wing and silly and naive, all this kind of stuff. And I really saw it totally differently. I was actually living in Bavaria for a while. I lived in Berlin actually for a little bit. I saw, particularly in Bavaria, I just saw this almost idyllic place. It just felt traditional. It felt truly German. Whereas America felt like a big strip mall with lots of different races all in it shopping. And so I had this almost reverse idea of what Europe was than everyone else, certainly everyone in the media that were, you know, obsessed with this Mars versus Venus, you know, America versus Europe nonsense.
Right.
And one thing that I could say now that's happening, and I'll, just to go back real quick, I think there has been a kind of divide within identitarian or nationalist or racial idealist movements between America and Europe, where, you know, Europeans will kind of say, oh, well, you're not really grounded. You guys just vote, you know, over there it's just all about race, but we're connected to, you know, traditional cultures and regional cultures and, you know, millennia and so on and so forth. So there's always been this divide, and I think that divide is still there. But I would say that what's interesting is that the arrow of history is really pointing in the direction of all of us being in the same boat. And it's really pointing towards something that a term that Nietzsche coined, which is a homogeneous European man. And that doesn't mean that there aren't regional and ethnic and cultural, sometimes religious differences. But it just means that our being in the world, our historical experience, is really becoming very similar. And it's becoming very similar quickly. The fact is, you know, I had heard the number actually 800,000 about refugees in Germany. I think the number is actually, as you should always do, just double anything a politician.
At least.
Any number that a politician tells you. So we're having 2 million non-whites entering Germany, and this is not stopping. I mean,
no.
You know, so this is going to happen. This is going to, I can't do the calculations, in my head, but we're going to get to a point where, you know, Germany is the same demographic boat as England. It's going to be the same demographic boat as the United States. I think actually a number I saw for England is that whites will be a minority in 2060.
Yeah, that's right.
In America, it's 2042. In a way, look, all those numbers don't, the exact year doesn't matter. All you have to look at is the arrow, the direction this is going. Where is this arrow pointing? And it's pointing to us being in the same boat. You know, as I've said in other contexts, we can talk about who we are, who we think we are, and that's important. But I think we should also talk about who other people think we are, to put ourselves in their shoes. In the eyes of a Syrian or African refugee, believe me, we are not a Bavarian Catholic. We are not a Ukrainian Catholic. We are not an Anglo-Protestant. We are not an Irishman. We are not a Scot. We are a European. We are a white man. And, you know, that's how we are viewed. And I think that has a lot of meaning and a lot of power. And I think we should respect that. And sometimes other people know you better than you know yourself. And so we are all becoming white. We're becoming a homogenous European man. That in a way sounds like a terrible term. It sounds like homogenized milk or something. But that's what we are. But no, we are Europeans. We are white people. And we are going to increasingly be in the same, having this very similar, the same historical experience. So I think it's going to be natural for us to come together. And, you know, when you look at things like all of these things amongst ourselves, like ethno-nationalism, all these things dividing white people, can we really look at any of these things as the way forward? I mean, you know, if you think about Ukrainian nationalism, which we've experienced over the past 2 years, what is that leading towards? Can we look upon anything that these Ukrainians have done of burning down apartment buildings, of slaughtering ethnic Russians, their neighbors, people they have so much in common with? Can we look upon that as some great boon for nationalism? Oh, we should be taking their side. This is so great. Mm. Can we look upon Scottish nationalism as anything other than just a stupid end of history movement done by leftists? You know, I mean,
right.
Their argument effectively, Scottish nationalists, is we can't be multiculturalists and leftists enough due to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, it is
unbelievable.
It's stupid.
God.
So how can we, that kind of stuff shouldn't have legitimacy. The stuff that's real, the stuff that resonates, the stuff that makes sense now, is our coming together and our realizing of just how much we have in common. And we do. And so I think that, you know, our movement, when you think about a movement that's racially idealist or identitarian, it's not going to go anywhere if you're just fighting against history. If you know, the flat earth society or many religious groups that just seem to be totally fighting against the wave of history. We have to be going with that wave. So we have to see all of these things that might seem terrible, massive Africans being shipped in, Hispanics coming across the border, anti-white stuff in the universities, all that. We need to see all of that stuff as, in a way, helping us understand ourselves. And all of this stuff is in a kind of negative fashion bringing us together. And so we need to kind of flip it around and turn it on itself. And so in this sense, I am a complete optimist. I think that our movement is part of the force of history. And our movement is the outcome of history. It's where this is leading. We are leading towards understanding ourselves as people, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I want to ask you more about that, actually, in the next hour, much more to talk about in terms of that. We did speak a little bit about that last time as well, but this is a really interesting point, and I think it's a valid one, although I kind of I want to disagree with you because I want to preserve those differences, but it doesn't negate the fact that, or it doesn't, invalidate this aspect that we have to get rid of all our differences as Europeans. But I definitely understand exactly what you're saying. So let's get into that a little bit more in the next. And before we do that, of course, let's talk a bit more about some of the details about where people can, you know, pick up tickets and everything else. We're talking about October 31st here, folks. So it's about a little bit less than 2 weeks when the show is up on the website. The website where you need to go is npievents.com. That's where you can pick up tickets, of course, and check out the speakers and everything else. What else should we know about the event, Richard, before we take a break here? And, of course, I want you to mention your websites as well and Radix Journal and whatnot.
Yeah, well, you can go to radixjournal.com, and right on the left-hand sidebar, you can see an events page, and that will take you there, or npievents.com, and you can register there. And actually, if you just Google Become Who We Are on Eventbrite, which is a kind of a market for events, you can definitely find it there. So, and you can, you know, pay versus be credit card or PayPal, all that kind of stuff. So I would definitely encourage you to at least check it out. And just real quick, the conference will have two parts. It will be basically all day, and it will include lunch and dinner. And the day conference will be probably a lot like conferences you're used to. There'll be speakers and some panels and podium and so on and so forth. Good food. And then the evening conference, I think, will be unlike almost every conference you've been to. It will be much less formal. We'll be able to take off our tie or maybe put on a Halloween costume if you want. That's certainly allowed. But there'll actually be a bar room, so you can always get drinks. We'll have kind of buffet style dinner. Again, good food, but it will be in a buffet, so you can kind of walk around and mingle. It really is making the conference more of a party, for lack of a better word, than anything else. And so I think the atmosphere is going to be festive, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. I think sometimes our conferences get a little too much like we're at graduate school or something. We should be taking notes and, you know, asking smart questions. There'll be a test on this afterward. I think it's better when our conferences are more like parties and less like graduate school. I went to graduate school. I don't want to go back there.
Very, very good. All right. We'll have the links up on the website, of course, in terms of where you need to go to check out Radix Journal and also the npievents.com. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of good people there, folks. So do come along if you feel so inclined. All right, Richard, stay with us. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more. Program and what we do, please check out the websites for more, redicecreations.com and redicesradio.net. You can hear us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, and of course add us to your iTunes if you want to. Also subscribe to our YouTube channel, of course. We have the links from our websites. If you're new to the show, we have a members website set up for our supporters and dedicated listeners, packed to the brim with everything that we've done since 2006. Old shows, both hours, videos, films, and much more. And of course, as a member, you can subscribe to the members' podcast feeds. Also, you can get both hours to your mobile device using a podcast app. Just go to the FAQ on redicemembers.com for the instructions and also some suggestions on some decent podcast apps. It's really simple to set up. In the member segments, we consider what the future holds for European descendants that are experiencing a loss of domestic rights and control, a kind of cultural sterilization, and the homogenization of ethnic differences as well. And, you know, Richard says that Europeans and Americans have been too comfortable and caught up in fantasies of universal peace and liberal values and capitalism for all. And now the international allure of decadent Western nihilism is responsible for inviting all the negative aspects of multiculturalism. We discuss how to reawaken the rebellious European spirit and inspire creative visionaries and the bourgeoisie alike to seize opportunities in advancing nationalist movements in Europe and America, and much more. So don't miss it. RedIceMembers.com is the website. Go there to sign up. All the information is right there for you. By the way, upcoming on Wednesday, we have a 314 with Lana, and then on Friday, we have a very good show with Ingrid Carlqvist and Conrad about the collapse of Sweden. The question is, what is going to happen next, and how do we prepare for what is coming? We also have James Lancia, Jay Widener, Lars Holger Holm, Erin Elizabeth, and David Dees. Good shows ahead, so stick around for more Red Ice Radio. But sign up at the members' website, and we'll talk to you right after this break.